completely and quickly. Simply rearranging your tasks this way can have an amazing impact on your productivity and motivation. And a quick suggestion about prioritization. Don't prioritize with numbers or labels. Avoid saying, "This is high priority, this is low priority." Likewise, don't say, "This is a 3, this is a 2, this is a 1, this is a 3, etc." Do that, and you'll almost always end up with a ton of really high priority things. That's not really prioritizing. Instead, prioritize visually. Put the most important thing at the top. When you're done with that, the next thing on the list becomes the next most important thing. That way, you'll only have a single next most important thing to do at a time. And that's enough. Make tiny decisions. Big decisions are hard to make and hard to change. And once you make one, the tendency is to continue believing you made the right decision, even if you didn't. You stop being objective. Once ego and pride are on the line, you can't change your mind without looking bad. The desire to save face trumps the desire to make the right call. And then there's inertia, too. The more steam you put into going in one direction, the harder it is to change course. Instead, make choices that are small enough that they're effectively temporary. When you make tiny decisions, you can't make big mistakes. These small decisions mean you can afford to change. There's no big penalty if you mess up. You just fix it. Making tiny decisions doesn't mean you can't make big plans or think big ideas. It just means you believe the best way to achieve those big things is one tiny decision at a time. Polar explorer Ben Saunders said that during his solo North Pole expedition, 31 marathons back-to-back, 72 days alone, the huge decision was often so horrifically overwhelming to contemplate that his day-to-day decision-making rarely extended beyond getting to that bit of ice a few yards in front of me. Attainable goals like that are the best ones to have, ones you can actually accomplish and build on. You get to say, "We nailed it. Done." Then you get going on the next one. That's a lot more satisfying than some pie-in-the-sky fantasy goal you never meet. Competitors. Don't copy. Sometimes copying can be part of the learning process, like when you see an art student replicating a painting in a museum, or a drummer playing along to John Bonham's solo on Led Zeppelin's Moby Dick. When you're a student, this sort of imitation can be a helpful tool on the path to discovering your own voice. Unfortunately, copying in the business arena is usually more nefarious. Maybe it's because of the copy and paste world we live in these days. You can steal someone's words, images, or code instantly, and that means it's tempting to try to build a business by being a copycat. That's a formula for failure, though. The problem with this sort of copying is it skips understanding, and understanding is how you grow. You have to understand why something works or why something is the way it is. When you just copy and paste, you miss that. You just repurpose the last layer instead of understanding all the layers underneath. So much of the work an original creator puts into something is invisible. It's buried beneath the surface. The copycat doesn't really know why something looks the way it looks, or feels the way it feels, or reads the way it reads. The copy is a faux finish. It delivers no substance, no understanding, and nothing to base future decisions on. Plus, if you're a copycat, you can never keep up. You're always in a passive position. You never lead. You always follow. You give birth to something that's already behind the times. Just a knockoff, an inferior version of the original. That's no way to live. How do you know if you're copying someone? If someone else is doing the bulk of the work, you're copying. Be influenced, but don't steal. Decommoditize your product. If you're successful, people will try to copy what you do. It's just a fact of life. But there's a great way to protect yourself from copycats. Make you part of your product or service. Inject what's unique about the way you think into what you sell. Decommoditize your product. Make it something no one else can offer. Look at Zappos.com, a billion-dollar online shoe retailer. A pair of sneakers from Zappos is the same as a pair from Foot Locker or any other retailer. But Zappos sets itself apart by injecting CEO Tony Hsieh's obsession with customer service into everything it does. At Zappos, customer service employees don't use scripts and are allowed to talk at length with customers. The call center and the company's headquarters are in the same place, not oceans apart. And all Zappos employees, even those who don't work in customer service or fulfillment, start out by spending 4 weeks answering phones and working in the warehouse. It's this devotion to customer service that makes Zappos unique among shoe sellers. Another example is Polyface, an environmentally friendly Virginia farm owned by Joel Salatin. Salatin has a strong set of beliefs and runs his business accordingly. Polyface sells the idea that it does things a bigger agribusiness can't do. Even though it's more expensive to do so, it feeds cows grass instead of corn and never gives them antibiotics. It never ships food. Anyone is welcome to visit the farm anytime and go anywhere. Try that at a typical meat processing plant. Polyface doesn't just sell chickens, it sells a way of thinking. And customers love Polyface for it. Some customers routinely drive from 150 miles away to get clean meat for their families. Pour yourself into your product and everything around your product, too. How you sell it, how you support it, how you explain it, and how you deliver it. Competitors can never copy the you in your product. Pick a fight. If you think a competitor sucks, say so. When you do that, you'll find that others who agree with you will rally to your side. Being the anti-blank is a great way to differentiate yourself and attract followers. For example, Dunkin' Donuts likes to position itself as the anti-Starbucks. Its ads mock Starbucks for using fritalian terms instead of small, medium, and large. Another Dunkin' campaign is centered on a taste test in which it beat Starbucks. There's even a site called DunkinBeatStarbucks.com where visitors can send e-cards with statements like, "Friends don't let friends drink Starbucks." Audi is another example. It's been taking on the old guard of car manufacturers. It puts old luxury brands like Rolls-Royce and Mercedes on notice and ads touting Audi as the fresh luxury alternative. Audi takes on Lexus's automatic parking systems with ads that say Audi drivers know how to park their own cars. Another ad gives a side-by-side comparison of BMW and Audi owners. The BMW owner uses the rearview mirror to adjust his hair, while the Audi driver uses the mirror to see what's behind him. Apple jabs at Microsoft with ads that compare Mac and PC owners, and 7-Up bills itself as the Uncola. Under Armour positions itself as Nike for a new generation. All these examples show the power and direction you can gain by having a target in your sights. Who do you want to take a shot at? You can even pitch yourself as the opponent of an entire industry. Dyson's Airblade starts with the premise that the hand dryer industry is a failure, and then sells itself as faster and more hygienic than the others. "I can't believe it's not butter" puts the enemy right there in its product name. Having an enemy gives you a great story to tell customers, too. Taking a stand always stands out. People get stoked by conflict. They take sides. Passions are ignited. And that's a good way to get people to take notice. Underdo your competition. Conventional wisdom says that to beat your competitors, you need to one-up them. If they have 4 features, you need 5, or 15, or 25. If they're spending $20,000, you need to spend $30,000. If they have 50 employees, you need 100. This sort of one-upping, Cold War mentality is a dead end. When you get suckered into an arms race, you wind up in a never-ending battle that costs you massive amounts of money, time, and drive. And it forces you to constantly be on the defensive, too. Defensive companies can't think ahead. They can only think behind. They don't lead, they follow. So what do you do instead? Do less than your competitors to beat them. Solve the simple problems and leave the hairy, difficult, nasty problems to the competition. Instead of one-upping, try one-downing. Instead of outdoing, try underdoing. The bicycle world provides a great example. For years, major bicycle brands focused on the latest in high-tech equipment. Mountain bikes with suspension and ultra-strong disc brakes, or lightweight titanium road bikes with carbon fiber everything. And it was assumed that bikes should have multiple gears, 3, 10, or 21. But recently, fixed-gear bicycles have boomed in popularity, despite being as low-tech as you can get. These bikes have just one gear. Some models don't have brakes. The advantage? They're simpler, lighter, cheaper, and don't require as much maintenance. Another great example of a product that is succeeding by underdoing the competition, the Flip. An ultra-simple, point-and-shoot, compact camcorder that's taken a significant percentage of the market in a short time. Look at all the things the Flip does not deliver. No big screen, and the tiny screen doesn't swing out for self-portraits either. No photo-taking ability. No tapes or discs. You have to offload the videos to a computer. No menus. No settings. No video light. No viewfinder. No special effects. No headphone jack. No lens cap. No memory card. No optical zoom. The Flip wins fans because it only does a few simple things, and it does them well. It's easy and fun to use. It goes places a bigger camera would never go and gets used by people who would never use a fancier camera. Don't shy away from the fact that your product or service does less. Highlight it. Be proud of it. Sell it as aggressively as competitors sell their extensive feature lists. Who cares what they're doing? In the end, it's not worth paying much attention to the competition anyway. Why not? Because worrying about the competition quickly turns into an obsession. What are they doing right now? Where are they going next? How should we react? Every little move becomes something to be analyzed, and that's a terrible mindset. It leads to overwhelming stress and anxiety. That state of mind is bad soil for growing anything. It's a pointless exercise anyway. The competitive landscape changes all the time. Your competitor tomorrow may be completely different from your competitor today. It's out of your control. What's the point of worrying about things you can't control? Focus on yourself instead. What's going on in here is way more important than what's going on out there. When you spend time worrying about someone else, you can't spend that time improving yourself. Focus on competitors too much, and you wind up diluting your own vision. Your chances of coming up with something fresh go way down when you keep feeding your brain other people's ideas. You become reactionary instead of visionary. You wind up offering your competitors' products with a different coat of paint. If you're planning to build the iPod killer or the next Pokemon, you're already dead. You're allowing the competition to set the parameters. You're not going to out-Apple Apple. They're defining the rules of the game. And you can't beat someone who's making the rules. You need to redefine the rules, not just build something slightly better. Don't ask yourself whether you're beating Apple or whoever the big boy is in your industry. That's the wrong question to ask. It's not a win or lose battle. Their profits and costs are theirs. Yours are yours. If you're just going to be like everyone else, why are you even doing this? If you merely replicate competitors, there's no point to your existence. Even if you wind up losing, it's better to go down fighting for what you believe in instead of just imitating others. Evolution. Say no by default. If I'd listened to customers, I'd have given them a faster horse. Henry Ford. It's so easy to say yes. Yes to another feature. Yes to an overly optimistic deadline. Yes to a mediocre design. Soon, the stack of things you've said yes to grows so tall, you can't even see the things you should really be doing. Start getting into the habit of saying no, even to many of your best ideas. Use the power of no to get your priorities straight. You rarely regret saying no, but you often wind up regretting saying yes. People avoid saying no because confrontation makes them uncomfortable. But the alternative is even worse. You drag things out, make things complicated, and work on ideas you don't believe in. It's like a relationship. Breaking one up is hard to do, but staying in it just because you're too chicken to drop the axe is even worse. Deal with a brief discomfort of confrontation up front and avoid the long-term regret. Don't believe that customer is always right stuff either. Let's say you're a chef. If enough of your customers say your food is too salty or too hot, you change it. But if a few persnickety patrons tell you to add bananas to your lasagna, you're going to turn them down, and that's okay. Making a few vocal customers happy isn't worth it if it ruins the product for everyone else. ING Direct has built the fastest-growing bank in America by saying no. When customers ask for a credit card, the answer is no. When they ask for an online brokerage, the answer is no. When they ask if they can open an account with $1 million in it, the answer is no. The bank has a strict deposit maximum. ING wants to keep things simple. That's why the bank offers just a few savings accounts, certificates of deposit, and mutual funds, and that's it. Don't be a jerk about saying no, though. Just be honest. If you're not willing to yield to a customer request, be polite and explain why. People are surprisingly understanding when you take the time to explain your point of view. You may even win them over to your way of thinking. If not, recommend a competitor if you think there's a better solution out there. It's better to have people be happy using someone else's product than disgruntled using yours. Your goal is to make sure your product stays right for you. You're the one who has to believe in it most. That way you can say, "I think you'll love it because I love it." Let your customers outgrow you. Maybe you've seen this scenario. There's a customer that's paying a company a lot of money. The company tries to please that customer in any way possible. It tweaks and changes the product per this one customer's requests and starts to alienate its general customer base. Then one day that big customer winds up leaving and the company is left holding the bag. And the bag is a product that's ideally suited to someone who's not there anymore. And now it's a bad fit for everyone else. When you stick with your current customers come hell or high water, you wind up cutting yourself off from new ones. Your product or service becomes so tailored to your current customers that it stops appealing to fresh blood. And that's how your company starts to die. After our first product had been around for a while, we started getting some heat from folks who had been with us from the beginning. They said they were starting to grow out of the application. Their businesses were changing, and they wanted us to change our product to mirror their newfound complexity and requirements. We said no. Here's why. We'd rather our customers grow out of our products eventually than never be able to grow into them in the first place. Adding power user features to satisfy some can intimidate those who aren't on board yet. Scaring away new customers is worse than losing old customers. When you let customers outgrow you, you'll most likely wind up with a product that's basic, and that's fine. Small, simple, basic needs are constant. There's an endless supply of customers who need exactly that. And there are always more people who are not using your product than people who are. Make sure you make it easy for these people to get on board. That's where your continued growth potential lies. People and situations change. You can't be everything to everyone. Companies need to be true to a type of customer more than a specific individual customer with changing needs. Don't confuse enthusiasm with priority. Coming up with a great idea gives you a rush. You start imagining the possibilities and the benefits. And of course, you want all that right away. So you drop everything else you're working on and begin pursuing your latest, greatest idea. Bad move. The enthusiasm you have for a new idea is not an accurate indicator of its true worth. What seems like a surefire hit right now often gets downgraded to just a nice-to-have by morning. And nice-to-have isn't worth putting everything else on hold. We have ideas for new features all the time. On top of that, we get dozens of interesting ideas from customers every day, too. Sure, it'd be fun to immediately chase all these ideas to see where they lead. But if we did that, we'd just wind up running on a treadmill and never get anywhere. So let your latest grand ideas cool off for a while first. By all means, have as many great ideas as you can. Get excited about them. Just don't act in the heat of the moment. Write them down and park them for a few days. Then evaluate their actual priority with a calm mind. Be at home good. You know what it feels like. You go to a store. You're comparing a few different products, and you're sold on the one that sounds like it's the best deal. It's got the most features. It looks the coolest. The packaging looks hot. There's sensational copy on the box. Everything seems great. But then you get it home and it doesn't deliver. It's not as easy to use as you thought it'd be. It has too many features you don't need. You end up feeling that you've been taken. You didn't really get what you needed, and you realize you spent too much. You just bought an in-store good product. That's a product you're more excited about in the store than you are after you've actually used it. Smart companies make the opposite. Something that's at-home good. When you get the product home, you're actually more impressed with it than you were at the store. You live with it and grow to like it more and more. And you tell your friends, too. When you create an at-home good product, you may have to sacrifice a bit of in-store sizzle. A product that executes on the basics beautifully may not seem as sexy as competitors loaded with bells and whistles. Being great at a few things often doesn't look all that flashy from afar. That's okay. You're aiming for a long-term relationship, not a one-night stand. This is as true for advertising as it is for in-store packaging or displays. We've all seen a TV ad for some revolutionary gadget that will change your life. But when the actual product arrives in the mail, it turns out to be a disappointment. In-media good isn't nearly as important as at-home good. You can't paint over a bad experience with good advertising or marketing. Don't write it down. How should you keep track of what customers want? Don't. Listen, but then forget what people said. Seriously. There's no need for a spreadsheet, database, or filing system. The requests that really matter are the ones you'll hear over and over. After a while, you won't be able to forget them. Your customers will be your memory. They'll keep reminding you. They'll show you which things you truly need to worry about. If there's a request that you keep forgetting, that's a sign that it isn't very important. The really important stuff doesn't go away. Promotion. Welcome obscurity. No one knows who you are right now, and that's just fine. Being obscure is a great position to be in. Be happy you're in the shadows. Use this time to make mistakes without the whole world hearing about them. Keep tweaking. Work out the kinks. Test random ideas. Try new things. No one knows you, so it's no big deal if you mess up. Obscurity helps protect your ego and preserve your confidence. Retailers experiment with test markets all the time for this reason. When Dunkin' Donuts thought about selling pizza, hot dogs, and other hot sandwiches, it test-marketed the products at just 10 select locations. Broadway shows also provide a great example of testing ideas on a small stage first. They routinely do a trial run in a smaller city before coming to New York. Testing out of town lets actors get some reps in front of a live audience before the show goes up in front of harsher critics and tastemakers. Would you want the whole world to watch you the first time you do anything? If you've never given a speech before, do you want your first speech to be in front of 10,000 people or 10 people? You don't want everyone to watch you starting your business. It makes no sense to tell everyone to look at you if you're not ready to be looked at yet. And keep in mind that once you do get bigger and more popular, you're inevitably going to take fewer risks. When you're a success, the pressure to maintain predictability and consistency builds. You get more conservative. It's harder to take risks. That's when things start to fossilize and change becomes difficult. If millions of people are using your product, every change you make will have a much bigger impact. Before, you might have upset 100 people when you changed something. Now you might upset thousands. You can reason with 100 people, but you need riot gear to deal with 10,000 angry customers. These early days of obscurity are something you'll miss later on when you're really under the microscope. Now's the time to take risks without worrying about embarrassing yourself. Build an audience. All companies have customers. Lucky companies have fans, but the most fortunate companies have audiences. An audience can be your secret weapon. A lot of businesses still spend big bucks to reach people. Every time they want to say something, they dip into their budgets, pull out a huge wad of cash, and place some ads. But this approach is both expensive and unreliable. As they say, you waste half of your ad budget. You just don't know which half. Today's smartest companies know better. Instead of going out to reach people, you want people to come to you. An audience returns often, on its own, to see what you have to say. This is the most receptive group of customers and potential customers you'll ever have. Over the past 10 years, we've built an audience of more than 100,000 daily readers for our Signal versus Noise blog. Every day they come back to see what we have to say. We may talk about design or business or software or psychology or usability or our industry at large. Whatever it is, these people are interested enough to come back to hear more. And if they like what we have to say, they'll probably also like what we have to sell. How much would it cost us to reach those 100,000 people every day the old-fashioned way? Hundreds of thousands? Millions? And how would we have done it? Running ads? Buying radio spots? Sending direct mail? When you build an audience, you don't have to buy people's attention. They give it to you. This is a huge advantage. So build an audience. Speak, write, blog, tweet, make videos, whatever. Share information that's valuable, and you'll slowly but surely build a loyal audience. Then when you need to get the word out, the right people will already be listening. Out-teach your competition. You can advertise. You can hire salespeople. You can sponsor events. But your competitors are doing the same things. How does that help you stand out? Instead of trying to outspend, outsell, or outsponsor competitors, try to outteach them. Teaching probably isn't something your competitors are even thinking about. Most businesses focus on selling or servicing, but teaching never even occurs to them. The Heffler Type Foundry teaches designers about type at typography.com. Etsy, an online store for things handmade, holds entrepreneurial workshops that explain best practices and promotional ideas to people who sell at the site. Gary Vaynerchuk, who owns a large wine shop, teaches people about wine online at Wine Library TV, and tens of thousands of people watch every day. Teach, and you'll form a bond you just don't get from traditional marketing tactics. Buying people's attention with a magazine or online banner ad is one thing. Earning their loyalty by teaching them forms a whole different connection. They'll trust you more. They'll respect you more. Even if they don't use your product, they can still be your fans. Teaching is something individuals and small companies can do that bigger competitors can't. Big companies can afford a Super Bowl ad. You can't. But you can afford to teach. And that's something they'll never do, because big companies are obsessed with secrecy. Everything at those places has to get filtered through a lawyer and go through layers of red tape. Teaching is your chance to outmaneuver them. Emulate chefs. You've probably heard of Emeril Lagasse, Mario Batali, Bobby Flay, Julia Child, Paula Deen, Rick Bayless, or Jacques Pepin. They're great chefs, but there are a lot of great chefs out there. So why do you know these few better than others? Because they share everything they know. They put their recipes in cookbooks and show their techniques on cooking shows. As a business owner, you should share everything you know too. This is anathema to most in the business world. Businesses are usually paranoid and secretive. They think they have proprietary this and competitive advantage that. Maybe a rare few do, but most don't. and those that don't should stop acting like those that do. Don't be afraid of sharing. A recipe is much easier to copy than a business. Shouldn't that scare Mario Batali? Why would he go on TV and show you how he does what he does? Why would he put all his recipes in cookbooks where anyone can buy and replicate them? Because he knows those recipes and techniques aren't enough to beat him at his own game. No one's going to buy his cookbook, open a restaurant next door, and put him out of business. It just doesn't work like that. Yet this is what many in the business world think will happen if their competitors learn how they do things. Get over it. So emulate famous chefs. They cook, so they write cookbooks. What do you do? What are your recipes? What's your cookbook? What can you tell the world about how you operate that's informative, educational, and promotional? This book is our cookbook. What's yours? Go behind the scenes. Give people a backstage pass and show them how your business works. Imagine that someone wanted to make a reality show about your business. What would they share? Now stop waiting for someone else and do it yourself. Think no one will care? Think again. Even seemingly boring jobs can be fascinating when presented right. What could be more boring than commercial fishing and trucking? Yet the Discovery Channel and History Channel have turned these professions into highly rated shows, Deadliest Catch and Ice Road Truckers. It doesn't need to be a dangerous job either. People love finding out the little secrets of all kinds of businesses, even one that makes those tiny marshmallows and breakfast cereals. That's why the Food Network's Unwrapped, which explores the secrets behind lunchbox treats, soda pop, movie candy, and more, is such a popular program. People are curious about how things are made. It's why they like factory tours or behind-the-scenes footage on DVDs. They want to see how the sets are built, how the animation is done, how the director casts the film, etc. They want to know how and why other people make decisions. Letting people behind the curtain changes your relationship with them. They'll feel a bond with you and see you as human beings instead of a faceless company. They'll see the sweat and effort that goes into what you sell. They'll develop a deeper level of understanding and appreciation for what you do. Nobody likes plastic flowers. The business world is full of professionals who wear the uniform and try to seem perfect. In truth, they just come off as stiff and boring. No one can relate to people like that. Don't be afraid to show your flaws. Imperfections are real, and people respond to real. It's why we like real flowers that wilt, not perfect plastic ones that never change. Don't worry about how you're supposed to sound and how you're supposed to act. Show the world what you're really like, warts and all. There's a beauty to imperfection. This is the essence of the Japanese principle of wabi-sabi. Wabi-sabi values character and uniqueness over a shiny facade. It teaches that cracks and scratches in things should be embraced. It's also about simplicity. You strip things down and then use what you have. Leonard Corin, author of a book on wabi-sabi, gives this advice. Pare down to the essence, but don't remove the poetry. Keep things clean and unencumbered, but don't sterilize. It's a beautiful way to put it. Leave the poetry in what you make. When something becomes too polished, it loses its soul. It seems robotic. So talk like you really talk. Reveal things that others are unwilling to discuss. Be upfront about your shortcomings. Show the latest version of what you're working on, even if you're not done yet. It's okay if it's not perfect. You might not seem as professional, but you will seem a lot more genuine. Press releases are spam. What do you call a generic pitch sent out to hundreds of strangers hoping that one will bite? Spam. That's what press releases are, too. Generic pitches for coverage sent out to hundreds of journalists you don't know, hoping that one will write about you. Let's dissect the purpose of a press release for a moment. It's something you send out because you want to be noticed. You want the press to pick up on your new company, product, service, announcement, or whatever. You want them to be excited enough to write a story about you. But press releases are a terrible way to accomplish that. They're tired and formulaic. There's nothing exciting about them. Journalists sift through dozens a day. They wind up buried under an avalanche of hyperbolic headlines and fake quotes from CEOs. Everything is labeled sensational, revolutionary, groundbreaking, and amazing. It's numbing. If you want to get someone's attention, it's silly to do exactly the same thing as everyone else. You need to stand out. So why issue press releases like everyone else does? Why spam journalists when their inbox is already filled with other people's spam? Furthermore, a press release is generic. You write it once and then send it to tons of reporters, people whom you don't know and who don't know you. And your first introduction is this vague, generic note you also send to everyone else? Is that the impression you want to make? Is that really going to get you the story? Instead, call someone. Write a personal note. If you read a story about a similar company or product, contact the journalist who wrote it. Pitch her with some passion, some interest, some life. Do something meaningful. Be remarkable. Stand out. Be unforgettable. That's how you'll get the best coverage. Forget about the Wall Street Journal. Forget about Time, Forbes, Newsweek, Business Week, the New York Times, and the Wall Street Journal. Pitching a reporter at one of these places is practically impossible. Good luck even getting a hold of that guy. And even if you do, he probably won't care anyway. You're not big enough to matter. You're better off focusing on getting your story into a trade publication or picked up by a niche blogger. With these outlets, the barrier is much lower. You can send an email and get a response, and maybe even a post, the same day. There's no editorial board or PR person involved. There's no pipeline your message has to go through. These guys are actually hungry for fresh meat. They thrive on being tastemakers, finding the new thing, and getting the ball rolling. That's why many big-time reporters now use these smaller sites to find new stories. Stories that start on the fringe can go mainstream quickly. We've been written up in big mainstream publications like Wired and Time, but we found that we actually get more hits when we're profiled on sites like Daring Fireball, a site for Mac nerds, or Lifehacker, a productivity site. Links from these places result in notable spikes in our traffic and sales. Articles in big-time publications are nice, but they don't result in the same level of direct, instant activity. Drug dealers get it right. Drug dealers are astute business people. They know their product is so good, they're willing to give a little away for free up front. They know you'll be back for more, with money. Emulate drug dealers. Make your product so good, so addictive, so can't miss, that giving customers a small free taste makes them come back with cash in hand. This will force you to make something about your product bite size. You want an easily digestible introduction to what you sell. This gives people a way to try it without investing any money or a lot of time. Bakeries, restaurants, and ice cream shops have done this successfully for years. Car dealers let you test drive cars before buying them. Software firms are also getting on board with free trials or limited use versions. How many other industries could benefit from the drug dealer model? Don't be afraid to give a little away for free, as long as you've got something else to sell. Be confident in what you're offering. You should know that people will come back for more. If you're not confident about that, you haven't created a strong enough product. Marketing is not a department. Do you have a marketing department? If not, good. If you do, don't think these are the only people responsible for marketing. Accounting is a department. Marketing isn't. Marketing is something everyone in your company is doing 24/7, 365. Just as you cannot not communicate, you cannot not market. Every time you answer the phone, it's marketing. Every time you send an email, it's marketing. Every time someone uses your product, it's marketing. Every word you write on your website is marketing. If you build software, every error message is marketing. If you're in the restaurant business, the after-dinner mint is marketing. If you're in the retail business, the checkout counter is marketing. If you're in a service business, your invoice is marketing. Recognize that all of these little things are more important than choosing which piece of swag to throw into a conference goodie bag. Marketing isn't just a few individual events, it's the sum total of everything you do. The myth of the overnight sensation. You will not be a big hit right away. You will not get rich quick. You are not so special that everyone else will instantly pay attention. No one cares about you. At least, not yet. Get used to it. You know those overnight success stories you've heard about? It's not the whole story. Dig deeper and you'll usually find people who have busted their asses for years to get into a position where things could take off. And on the rare occasion that instant success does come along, it usually doesn't last. There's no foundation there to support it. Trade the dream of overnight success for slow, measured growth. It's hard, but you have to be patient. You have to grind it out. You have to do it for a long time before the right people notice. You may think you can speed up the process by hiring a PR firm. Don't bother. You're just not ready for that yet. For one thing, it's too expensive. Good PR firms can cost upward of $10,000 per month. That's a waste of money right now. Plus, you're still just a no-name with a product no one's ever heard about. Who's going to write about that? Once you have some customers and a history, you'll have a story to tell. But just launching isn't a good story. And remember, great brands launch without PR campaigns all the time. Starbucks, Apple, Nike, Amazon, Google, and Snapple all became great brands over time, not because of a big PR push up front. Start building your audience today. Start getting people interested in what you have to say. And then keep at it. In a few years, you too will get to chuckle when people discuss your overnight success. Hiring. Do it yourself first. Never hire anyone to do a job until you've tried to do it yourself first. That way, you'll understand the nature of the work. You'll know what a job well done looks like. You'll know how to write a realistic job description and which questions to ask in an interview. You'll know whether to hire someone full-time or part-time, outsource it, or keep doing